and achievements in the last year and a half. Considering the policies of the government that cooperation with neighboring countries is on the agenda, we saw this cooperation at a very good level, especially with the holding of the regional ministerial meeting of environmental cooperation for a better future in Tehran last year. God willing, the statute of the Regional Environmental Fund is being discussed between the countries of the region, and based on this important achievement, the United Nations thanked Iran in its recent resolution and introduced the Islamic Republic as the host of the International Conference on Combating Sand and Dust Storms in 2023.
The achievements of the First National Conference on Diplomacy and Cross-Border Environmental Challenges will be useful in the process of decision-making and adopting new policies in the country's environmental sectors. Mahdi Abbasian, Tehran.
An official delegation from the Arab Interparliamentary Union has met with Syrian President Bashar al-Assad in Damascus. Assad said the visit shows there are Arab institutions still capable of taking action for the interest of Arab people. He also thanked those countries for their rapid response in assisting Syrians following the earthquake. The head of the union expressed solidarity with the Syrian people, underlining the importance of taking necessary action to ensure Syria's return to playing an active role in the Arab world. The delegation, which includes heads of parliaments of the UAE, Egypt, Libya, Jordan, and Palestine, then headed to the Syrian parliament, where they met with its speaker, Hamoud Sabbagh.
We represent Arab people. This is a historic visit. We wanted to convey a message of support to the brotherly Syrian people. We had a high-level meeting with President Assad, who is a highly educated person. We had a rich dialogue with him. We were glad to meet him. In brief, we came to say that the people we represent support Syria.
Members of the delegation called for the restoration of relations between Syria and the Arab world, promising to exert all efforts for that purpose. They expressed readiness to offer all the help needed to alleviate the people's suffering after the devastating earthquake that hit the country, while calling for all sanctions crippling Syria's economy to be lifted.
The streets of the Yemeni capital were poured with a huge number of Yemeni protesters who came out to express support for Yemen's late president, Saleh al-Sammad. Saleh al-Sammad was assassinated by the Saudi-led coalition back in 2018. He is hailed here as Yemen's martyred president.
We came out today to express solidarity and loyalty to the martyred president who sacrificed his life on the path of Allah. And we say to the killers of al-Sammad, your criminal and reckless atrocities has given new life to a nation. The Yemeni people will accept nothing but the just punishment against the perpetrators.
Protesters also expressed solidarity with Palestinians who are suffering from Israeli regime attacks and crackdowns. Yemen's main cause is the Palestinian cause, according to government officials who addressed the crowd at the rally.
To the Palestinian people, we say, your blood is our blood, and our blood is your blood. Every drop of blood that is spilled in the land of Palestine is a drop of blood being spilled here in Yemen. Any oppression Palestinians face is considered oppression that is happening to us and every honorable Muslim.
The Palestinian cause will always remain dear and deep in the hearts and souls of the Yemeni people.
The latest protest in Sana'a comes in the midst of ongoing political efforts by the UN Special Envoy to Yemen to reach a deal between the Yemeni government and the Saudi-led coalition to end the conflict. Even if the war comes to an end, the Ansarullah-backed Yemeni government will continue to face many challenges from world powers, given its unequivocal support for Palestine.
Despite 8 years of war and a strangling blockade that has stirred Yemen into becoming the world's worst humanitarian crisis, tens of thousands of Yemenis remain defiant and showing support for the Palestinians who remain occupied by the Israeli regime. Yusuf Mawri, Sana'a.
Stop that war! Stop that war!
Thousands of kilometers away from the front lines of the Russia-Ukraine war, an appeal for peace from central London.
But today's protest means that while there may be consensus at the official political level here in Britain and other European countries, anti-war sentiment among ordinary people is on the rise.
Years before the conflict began, anti-war campaigners had warned of the consequences of a NATO expansion to countries that share borders with Russia. Their warnings were ignored.
The calls for it to go on and on, which is what all the governments are talking about now, is really a call for more of this and for an escalation of the war with the possible threat of nuclear wars.
Но нигде.
That threat became more real last week after Russian President Vladimir Putin announced his country was halting its participation in a nuclear arms reduction treaty with the U.S. A response to U.S.-led NATO nations sending tanks and other armaments to Ukraine. Wars come at a cost, and it's not just the Ukrainians and the Russians impacted by this one. The ripple effects of what's happening on the battlefield have already washed up on European shores.
We are seeing an impact on fuel bills. We are seeing an impact on food prices. But I think also there is a growing cynicism that there's no money to pay nurses a decent pay rise. There's no money for the National Health Service. But the British government seems to have endless coffers of money to provide arms for Ukraine.
After a year of war that's seen tens of thousands killed, tens of millions displaced, and entire cities destroyed, will this renewed call for peace make a difference? Saeed Pourreza, London.
At one of Lebanon's local supermarkets, only a few items cost a bundle of Lebanese pounds. The country's cost of living crisis is taking a heavy toll on people, as 80,000 lira equal only $1.
As Lebanon enters a third year of a deepening economic crisis, basic necessities like food and medicine have become more expensive than ever before. It has become almost a daily struggle for some families to put food on the table.
The Western sanctions on the one hand and domestic corruption on the other hand have been affecting the situation, and it is the people who are suffering.
Many blame those in power for heeding to U.S. and Western control of monetary activity. People on the street say the increasing rate of the dollar is a major contributor to the crisis.
If the dollar became high, 1,000, the items more and more, not the real price. And you can see this in other supermarkets. You go, one supermarket is cheaper than others. And around 20,000-30,000. Why? So they don't, no control should be controlled, because really nobody can afford many things now in the supermarkets because it's high prices.
God help the families who have children and are in need of basic items like milk and yogurt. Bread has become 10 times more expensive. Even onions are not affordable now. And everything is in dollar.
Currency depreciation and the lifting of subsidies have resulted in a dramatic rise in prices of medicine as well, adding to the problems of a deteriorating Lebanese economy.
Lebanon's national currency has lost now more than 90% of its value. Many believe that as long as imports are priced in U.S. dollars, which controls the market, there is very little hope for economic recovery. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
A night of fun and music with the exceptional performance of the St. Petersburg Ensemble, followed by classical pieces by Tehran's Symphonic Orchestra. This is how the 38th edition of the Fajr International Music Festival wrapped up a week of orchestral, traditional, and pop performances. Aside from the outstanding performances, the event did not fail to celebrate the best of the best, with the prestigious Barbat Prize awarded in four different sections, this time also awarded to Iranian folk music.
The 38th edition of the Fajr Music Festival was very special in terms of the large number of folk music pieces that were performed. and the special award that was given to the musicians in this genre.
I'm honored to have won this prize. I've been working very hard and I'm extremely overwhelmed right now.
This year, over 2,000 Iranian and foreign musicians, including 30 music bands, gathered in the capital to present their latest musical compositions in 7 concert halls in Tehran and several others in over a dozen provinces.
The Fajr Music Festivals this time was even more glamorous than ever because of the large number of musicians who took part, not just presenting a diverse culture with its region performing its own music, but also because of upholding the name Fajr.
Fajr means dawn in Farsi and refers to a 10-day period that led to the victory of the Islamic Revolution. This has been the reason to hold cultural events, including a theater, a film, and a music festival, going by the same name every year. And this is the final part of that trio, leaving the audience at awe with its unique performances until next year, when another edition of the Fajr Theater, Film, and Music Festivals will once again bring artists and enthusiasts together in the Iranian capital. Gisumish Ahmadi, Tehran.
The U.S. wasted no time scrambling jets in response to North Korea's recent long-range missile launch, deploying strategic assets capable of carrying nuclear bombs with South Korean fighter aircraft. At the United Nations, the U.S. placed responsibility for the tension on North Korea.
We echo the Council's consistent demand that the DPRK comply with its obligations under numerous UN Security Council resolutions, abandon its weapons of mass destruction and ballistic missile program in a complete, verifiable, and irreversible manner, and engage constructively in diplomacy.
North Korea has steadily developed a nuclear deterrent in the face of expanding U.S. militarization of South Korea. China calls for dialogue.
On the Korean Peninsula issue, we adhere to pursuing in parallel the establishment of a peace mechanism and the denuclearization process of the peninsula, and address the legitimate concerns of all parties in a balanced manner, and maintain peace and stability on the Korean Peninsula.
The U.S. has agreed to frequently deploy nuclear-capable weapons to the region at South Korea's request. The U.S. and South Korea seem to have agreed to raise the tension on the Korean Peninsula in an attempt to somehow force North Korea into negotiations on arms control or denuclearization. This reverses the policy of the previous South Korean government that brought about a reduction in tension through engagement and dialogue. Local analysts warn of potential conflict.
When North Korea does something, the South Korea-U.S. alliance reacts. And if the South Korea-U.S. alliance does something, North Korea reacts. And this vicious cycle continues. The stronger the deployment of U.S. strategic assets, the more fragile the peace on the Korean Peninsula, and the faster the arms race. And this risks creating a security dilemma, and more seriously, a war crisis.
More regional tension seems inevitable as South Korea seeks to celebrate the 70th anniversary of its alliance with the U.S. with ever larger war games. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Tensions are flaring up again across the Palestinian territories as the Israeli regime has intensified its bloody crackdown there. After a day of mayhem and bloodshed in the West Bank by the regime's forces, Israeli warplanes rained down missiles on the besieged Gaza Strip, prompting Palestinians to hit back with rockets. Wednesday's Israeli raid on West Bank was the deadliest in about 2 decades. Nearly a dozen people were killed and scores more were injured after the regime's forces, backed by armored vehicles, surrounded the city of Nablus and opened fire on the people, including teenagers and elderly. Thousands of Palestinians gathered to mourn the death of their loved ones. Nablus and the nearby city of Jenin have repeatedly come under Israeli attacks over the last couple of months. Palestinians find themselves helpless in front of the occupying regime and its ruthless agenda.
What is happening on the ground is organized state terrorism, which the Israeli occupation government is solely responsible for. The international silence regarding these crimes is an encouragement for the occupation.
Many believe that the inaction of the UN and other international bodies, as well as unwavering support of certain governments for Israel, emboldens the regime to go ahead with its crimes against Palestinians. In doing Israeli crimes over the past several decades, Palestinians have realized that they cannot expect more than condemnation of Israel from the international community.
The right response to Israel is the activation of resistance across the occupied territories and retaliatory attacks against the regime's forces and settlers.
The Israeli regime has piled up pressure on Palestinians with deadly crackdown, illegal detention, and demolition of their homes. Years of crippling siege of the Gaza Strip is yet another example how the regime has turned the Palestinian territory into an open prison. The people in Gaza and the West Bank have been living in fear and agony as they lose their loved ones almost on a daily basis. But Israel's Western and regional backers keep watching the regime's bloodshed silently.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
Supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate, praise belongs to Allah who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day he appointed for a rising. To thee belongs praise, for thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst thou willed, thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to thee belongs praise, for thou created, then proportioned, and ordained, and decreed, and gave death, and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure. And provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
From Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Tomatoes, bell peppers, cucumbers, and several other vegetables are being rationed across the United Kingdom, along with some fruit in some stores. Who or what is to blame for this crisis? Well, depending on who one asks, the answer can range from the cold weather in Spain to increased production costs to bureaucratic red tape, as well as high energy costs, thus less production in greenhouses. Whichever the answer, the reality is that, for now, attaining these vegetables will be more difficult. But the bigger question, is this just a one-time crisis, or is it a sign of increased food insecurity, especially as the Ukraine-Russian war continues and affects both the energy and agricultural sectors?
Tomatoes, one of your five a day. Supermarket giants in the UK are now only allowing three of these and other salad ingredients to their customers. And where there is availability, you'll have to pay a premium, especially when it comes to out-of-season fresh produce. Here is why.
Starting with climate change, 2022 was the second hottest year in Europe. Heat waves and extreme temperatures in Spain, one of Europe's biggest food producers, have meant fewer crops to harvest. The same problem with supplying countries such as Morocco in North Africa. But the UK has its own well-established food industry. One important component of it, greenhouses, many hectares of which now lay barren.
There is a problem, of course, with the high price of gas that is used to heat up these greenhouses. They do require quite a lot of gas input, and that's quite expensive. And the problem is that the supermarkets are also being very tough on pricing. So it's not easy to then raise your prices and get what you want from the supermarkets. And so rather than produce anything at a loss, some producers have obviously decided not to produce at all.
And the UK faces another particular issue. Most of its fruit and veg come from the European Union. The country's exit from the bloc has meant extra costs and bureaucracy added to the strain, especially on the supply of perishable goods.
Brexit has caused a shortage of labour, and a shortage of labour means a shortage of fruit and vegetables at the end of the day. More bureaucracy, and more bureaucracy means more costs, and more costs mean less profits, and therefore lower UK production. It's as simple as that.
The solution, food-producing organisations say, is for the government to provide more support, such as replacing high-carbon fertilizers with low-carbon alternatives, or investing more in soil-free indoor growing techniques, such as vertical farming. Saeed Purza, London.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Now I'd like to welcome my guests to the program. Out of London, economist and author Steve Keen. And out of Edinburgh, Mick Napier, activist and commentator. Welcome both of you to the program. I'd like to start off with Steve. I mean, there have been a range of shortages in the UK, and this latest one now deals with vegetables. What do you make of the overall shortages? What do you think is behind it?
Well, of course, as you said in your introduction, there are a lot of disparate forces that have caused it, Brexit being one, shortage of labour to pick vegetables in open fields. But I think the one which is going to be the longest impact and the most important is the rising cost of energy. That's been inflated again by another unusual event, the Ukraine war, but and an availability of Russian energy. But this is going to be a continuing trend, and really it's the energy cost of production which is rising and which will continue to rise that's going to be the most damaging factor, forcing rationing upon the country.
Yeah, and speaking of rationing, I mean, Mick, how does this affect the psyche of the average Brit, knowing that they're limited in their buying? Not only that, and of course, with the costs, the costs are increasing.
The average Brit's an elusive creature. Different people are paying very different costs, very different prices for the current situation. Your introduction was very comprehensive, and the economist in London has added something of great value. But I think we need to see this war as a war of choice has really pushed up energy prices. It's also pushed up the cost of fertilizer, and it looks like this will continue into the foreseeable future. There's no end in sight. And for many Brits, this, of course, comes on top of, it's not separate from, there has always been food rationing, but in the last few years, it's been by cost. And many, many British people have seen 16% rise in basic food inflation, the cost of basic food. And now you see in one of the richest countries in the world, about one person in nine reports that they have used a food bank because they were unable to buy the kind of food that they wanted over the last year. So people are paying, they're paying the cost of many, many things. The food chain is so fragile and so very, very long, not just to Morocco, but even beyond bringing stuff to British supermarkets, because British supermarkets have sought to knock every penny off the price that they have to pay producers. They've gone to Morocco because it's cheaper than in the Netherlands, and that has led to fragility in the food chain. So we see now, because of not just very unusual weather patterns, which are almost certainly due to global warming, but we've seen also crises in agriculture around the Mediterranean. In Britain, we have massive quantities of water. We have more than enough in most places, but in the Mediterranean, The aquifers, the water table is being exhausted. The River Po in the north of Italy is over 3 meters below its minimum measuring point, more than 3 meters below where it usually is in the hottest part of summer. So the water table is being used up. The model of intensive agriculture in order to push down prices as low as possible and feed the voracious maw of British supermarkets is a contributory factor to this. And ooh, British farmers are beginning to flag up the fact that they have been pushed into a crisis by the constant pressure, the downward pressure on the cost of food.
Well, Steve, is this food rationing indicative of overall economic deterioration of life as prices are soaring? I mean, how is this affecting the overall quality of life?
The quality of life has been challenged by the ridiculously bad distribution of income in this country, and that's been accentuated by 15 years of austerity policies, which really cut back on the income of the poor far more than they affect the rich, of course. And so you had, in effect, you had rationing by price of some substantial time. Now it's so extreme, you can't let those prices rise. People will be starving, unable to buy food at all when it's hardly through in the price system. So physical rationing is coming in, and I think this is going to be the flavor of the future.
Well, Mick, you talked about this war of choice. I want to look at this. I mean, is it that the UK and other European countries have basically just shot themselves in the foot when they could have tried to force the hand of Ukraine to sit down and negotiate with the Russians? They're so gung-ho about this war that is backfiring on themselves. How do you see it?
I think we need to be cautious about the metaphor of shot themselves in the foot. We have to ask who themselves are. Some people are making hay during every war produces great opportunities for some people, the arms companies and various other corporations, and they've never had things better. We've had what the mainstream media here have called obscene profit levels. In energy companies, multiplied by, I think, two or three. My economist friend can correct me if I've exaggerated that. But some people are doing very, very well. But, of course, the majority of people have to pay for this war. And while NATO and Russia are ripping up Eastern and you know, Eastern Europe, obviously contributing to the longer-term crisis of global warming, we also then have to pay. Everything is connected to the rise in energy prices and the rise in fertilizer prices, where Russia plays a crucial role in world exports. And that is a price which our rulers are simply telling us we have to pay. Now, as a friend has also said, this builds on top of a couple of decades, actually, of endless austerity, so that young people, not so young people in the job market, as compared to myself, they have an experience of nothing other than austerity. Previous generations saw things getting better and better and better, could look forward to a generally improving standard of living in this country and many other countries. But now, increasing numbers of young adults and not so young adults continue to live with their parents because they don't want to, but they cannot even afford homes for themselves. And there are many other measures of the quality of life. I mean, this is a very dirty country. It's lawless in the sense that dangerous chemicals are being pumped into supposedly protected rivers, beauty spots, and of course nobody goes to prison. So yes, the quality of life is deteriorating. Not only that, it's widely seen to be deteriorating. And a lot of people no longer use the phrase Great Britain. They use other adjectives.
Well, Mick, let me stay with you because you just talked about something I want to look at a little bit closer. You're saying that there are a few that are definitely profiting from this. Are you saying the powers that be are willing to destroy the majority of British people's lives just for the sake of their own profits? And if so, are we seeing any kind of backlash from the people themselves about all of this?
Well, there's certainly a backlash. There's a reckoning on the way. But it comes as no surprise. It's shocking, but not surprising. The most loved and the most treasured aspect of British political and social life is very probably the National Health Service, which I used last month and did not pay $20,000 as I would have paid in the USA for the service I got without anybody ever raising the question of money. That is being privatized at an alarming rate, and people know that. Right across the board, we see, as our economist friend mentioned, and he's an expert where I am not, incredible inequality, that the production of billionaires on a huge scale at one pole and the production of poverty at the other pole. And we see people, you know, having to choose between, as the phrase goes, heating or eating. It's cold at the moment in Britain, and a lot of people have to choose between enough food for them and their children and heating their homes. This is not a conspiracy theory. This is widely known and widely acknowledged. And the very popular perception reflected in opinion polls is that this government simply doesn't care. It is in hock to to vested interests, which are very wealthy. It is corrupt in many, many ways, coming out in scandal after scandal. And yes, they're quite prepared that we pay the price for their war of choice. And it looks like we will be expected to pay the price while they make fortunes out of this war. So I don't think it's right to say they shot themselves in the foot as if we are a unit. There's a massive discrepancy in how people are benefiting or suffering because of this dreadful war, a war of choice.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
You heard what Mick said. I mean, it's pretty mind-boggling to think one of the richest countries in the world that more and more people have to choose, as he said, between heating or eating. Where do you see this situation going? Because if there's such a disconnect between the ruling class and those who are ruled, do you see, as I was talking to him earlier about a backlash, do you see growing discontent by the British people in dealing with this lack of equality?
Certainly growing discontent. Whether they'll do anything about it, again, is rather a national characteristic. If this was France, you'd have riots. You've certainly had them in Italy over cost of energy, people burning their energy bills. So the whole idea of privatization pushed the costs of staples like energy onto people and their individual incomes. And the idea was that you have a much higher income because, hey, neoliberalism and deregulation is going to make everybody much, much richer, and you won't need welfare in 40 years' time. We're now in 40 years' time, and the National Statistical Office published a report last month showing that 25% of Britons were unable to keep themselves warm during November and December. So the incomes haven't risen. The promise of neoliberalism hasn't delivered through. The inequality has. The lack of access to resources and the lack of power. I think the British will put up for it for far too long before they start to revolt, unfortunately. Be better off if they behave like the French.
Well, Mick, do you see the role of the Brexit playing anything in all of this? I mean, how has that affected the overall food supply chain, or has it affected it in your perspective?
Oh, for sure. Everyone agrees, apart from the government denialists, that it has affected it to some degree. The question is of whether this is the major factor or there are other even deeper factors. I think Brexit was a profoundly irrational reaction by millions of British people towards the fact that something was wrong with their lives. They didn't like what was happening, and they were encouraged by the current government and its predecessors to think that the EU was the enemy, supposedly. I mean, Boris Johnson, who later became Prime Minister, used to send articles, constant articles from Brussels, fabricating ideas that the EU was about to enforce square tomatoes or straight bananas on the British people. It was madness to a degree. It was profoundly irrational. But I think also now that we have a crisis caused by war, caused by ecological degradation in many parts of Europe, it's not mainly the fault of Brexit. Because of Brexit, of course, the Spanish producers, find it much easier to sell inside the EU than to take the leap of faith and cross the channel and have all sorts of paperwork. And also the Moroccans as well probably find it easier than that. So the EU, it plays a role. Perhaps even more importantly, the Brexit thing was whipping up jingoism against foreigners. Foreigners were the problem. Europeans, but also dark-skinned foreigners, asylum seekers, etc., etc. And it's also profoundly irrational how the British government has created a situation where farmers don't have the skilled labour that they need to harvest the crops. And the latest figures were that millions of pounds, millions of a huge weight of crops has rotted in the field because the farmers got the crops, actually produced them, and then they didn't have the labour to harvest it because British workers won't work for those wages. So you get the irrationality like that. Another irrationality, for example, to show what this country's like, I mean, I used to be working out in the university sector, and the government tried to destroy that cash cow because foreign students from China, India, many, many parts of the world had been paying top dollar and had kept many universities afloat. And the British government then, in order to placate their racist rank and file, their electoral base, said that they would reduce this, took steps to make the universities even a hostile environment for students who wanted to come here. So there's a little bit of craziness going on here. But at the end, at the bottom, we find a lot of people suffering a lot and a few people benefiting absolutely overwhelmingly because of the war and the various intertwined crises.
And Steve, how do you see this continuing from here? I mean, if this war continues, we are seeing a limited number of shortages right now in the UK, but do you see the situation exacerbating, and not just in the UK, but throughout Europe?
Oh, it'll be cycles in this. We could easily have a bumper harvest by sheer luck, like the Southern Californians now have all their water supplies rebuilt by an enormous winter storm that hit Los Angeles. So weird things like that will push us back into a bit of apparent stability for a while. But the overall trend is going to get worse, I think, because we are just now beginning to realize how dependent we are upon oil, and that includes our food. If we didn't have the Haber-Bosch process to make fertilizer out of oil, then we'd only support 2 billion people on this planet, not 8 billion. And if we're being pushed to the point where we can't use that oil anymore, then we're going to find how fragile our systems really are. I think it's just the first taste.
And Mickey, your take on all of this? I mean, it just seems that the so-called elite who are supposed to look at these things and set up equations to see what will equal what, it seems like they really didn't do their job. And as you said, now the average person is suffering. But your prognosis in general of things to come?
Well, I mean, I hear what Steve is saying, that the British are not the French or the Greeks and maybe far too tolerant of what's being done to them compared to other countries. But I'm old enough to remember, not when the British government spoke about the French disease, a readiness to strike and a readiness to take on their government to protect their interests. But back in the 70s and 80s of the last century, the French and others spoke about the British disease, because the British were very prone to rebellion. And in fact, Margaret Thatcher, we should remember, was forced to resign because of a popular revolt. McDonald's were trashed and riots in London. I mean, riots are as British as apple pie. And the great majority of people, when some anarchists trashed McDonald's, the great majority of people actually said, well, she had it coming. And a few weeks later, Margaret Thatcher was booted out by the Conservative Party, and she couldn't even appear in Britain at Conservative Party events thereafter because of the opprobrium and the hostility that had been generated by a singularly unequal and unfair tax that she had introduced. Now, what we've got is not just a single tax, the poll tax, which the great majority of people hated. We've got multiple versions of that, which vacuum up what wealth there is and suck it up to the top of society and leave people at the bottom worse off than they were the year before. So I think the British have a higher boiling point, shall we say, than other countries. But when they move, they move. And I think everything is set now for very unpredictable futures, shall we say. But it does not preclude a popular political revolt against what's been done to the great majority of people for far too many years.
All right. And on that note, I appreciate both of you being with us. We're out of time. Steve Kinn, economist and author out of London, McNapier, activist and commentator out of Edinburgh. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another Spotlight.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, if you remember, we discussed the liberation of Khorramshahr and the events related to this great juncture in the history of the Islamic Revolution and the eight-year holy defense. In this episode, we are going to dwell upon Imam Khomeini's ideas about the status of women in society. Stay tuned, please. One of the important issues which had occupied the minds of combatants and thinkers during the struggles against the despotic regime of Shah in Iran was the clarification of the status of women in society. Imam Khomeini was always asked by journalists on the position of women after the victory of the Islamic Revolution. The father of the Islamic Revolution always tried to clarify the Islamic view, an approach towards individual, social, and political rights of women. He considered women as the core and axis of the family unit and believed that if woman succeeds to achieve high grades of knowledge and spiritual and ethical values, she will be able to train children and keep the family climate more successfully. This will lead to an advanced society. The Imam was of the opinion that women's presence in family and their impact on men and children determines the course of society and the movement of mankind toward perfection and sublimity. Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, strongly condemned the instrumental look of the Shah regime to women, which had trivialized them into the means of pornography and promiscuity. he would always support individual and social freedoms of women, but never agreed with turning them into the tools of meeting the carnal desires of libertine men. Imam Khomeini always called for serious and active participation of women in various scientific and cultural arenas. He said, "The Islamic culture is oppressed, and you ladies should be engaged in scientific and cultural fronts like men." Imam Khomeini's unsparing support for education and progress of women in scientific fields was quite clear in his family and personal life. While many traditional and religious strata were opposed to education of women, the Imam permitted his wife to acquire religious sciences and modern sciences. He would even help Ms. Saghafi in her courses. Ms. Saghafi says, "After receiving the diploma of the sixth grade, I went to Badriya High School and studied grade 7 there. And 2 months after starting grade 8, I chose a private teacher for French language. When my father left Qom for Tehran, I studied Jama'ul Muqaddamat with him for a while. Jama'ul Muqaddamat is the preliminary book for the students of seminaries. After marriage, Imam Khomeini would teach me. After a while, he told me that I needed no teacher as I was talented." Imam Khomeini strongly defended women's participation in political and social scenes. He maintained that the victory of the revolution was the result of the efforts and self-sacrifices of ladies. However, he believed that women's social and political activities shouldn't become superficial and ceremonial. In view of this, he vehemently opposed the special bill during the Pahlavi regime, which would give women the right to vote. As a matter of fact, the Imam was not opposed to women's right to vote. He rather considered the move to deceive people, as in those days, even men had no real right to vote, and it was only the nominees, dictated by the Shah, who could enter the parliament. Imam Khomeini would say, "Islam intends woman and man to grow. Islam has liberated women from the miseries of the era of ignorance. Islam wants to preserve women's status and respect. It wants to give position to woman to end being a tool." According to Imam Khomeini's thoughts, after the victory of the Islamic Revolution, women's social and political rights were recognized in the constitution, and many women have participated in various posts for the past decades. Presently, a notable number of the MPs are ladies, and over 60% of university students are girls. In the first years of the Islamic Republic, some backward and short-sighted persons disagreed with women's social and political participation. But Imam Khomeini stood against them and promoted the issue while preserving women's status and dignity. The Imam's wife says, "One day I heard that the Imam had sent a message to the Iranian nation and stressed that it should be read out by Ms. Maryam Riazi on TV. There was an argument on the reason for Imam's emphasis. Everyone would say something till Ahmad said, 'The main reason is to remove the problem that had occurred on IRIB. The IRIB president says that Some of the anchors were ladies, and Ms. Riazi was one of them who had been an anchor since pre-revolution. She was the best female anchor. The social atmosphere in those days was against employing female anchors. But as male anchors were needed in the battlefronts, the IRIB was in shortage of anchors. Imam Khomeini had heard the issue and said that women can do the job.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.